Two Starfleet captains.
Who attacked you?
We don't know.
One terrible secret.
Interspatial fissures are opening on decks 10, 6, and 1.
No way out.
I think you know the reason we're under attack.
It's a Voyager season finale.
If you don't stop what you're doing, we'll both be destroyed.
But won't slow down.
Janeway to 7 of 9.
Until the final moment.
They're breaking through!
Of an unforgettable showdown.
Captain! Captain!
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Chicken Sandwich Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
Cam Chicken Sandwich... We can get into that later, but this is Tyler Orton practicing my next song routine. I like to call this one, Oh My Darling, Camentine.
Oh, wow. And we're here this week to talk about, where we'll tie all these threads of bizarre jokes up front together, talking about the Voyager Season 5 finale, Season 6 premiere, Equinox.
Yeah, Cam, this is a very exciting two-parter, one that I've actually been looking forward to for a long, long time. I think, actually, my most anticipated two-parter since Basics for Star Trek Voyager, at least. We've done a couple Deep Space Nine ones, but this one I'm very excited to talk about, because a question that I've been thinking about for a long, long time is this an episode where, I don't know, Star Trek Voyager should have really been Star Trek Equinox this whole time? Is this what Star Trek Voyager should have been this entire time?
Well, I think we'll have to dive into that question as we kind of talk about the episode. I mean, I think it's a tough question to answer with a yes or a no, because I think in some ways, yes. In other ways, I think it'd be pretty grueling television to sit through week to week. But I definitely think this two-parter does, I think inadvertently, raise a lot of questions about the show it's taking place in.
Yeah.
And the ongoing drama, quote-unquote, of the show that, you know, seems engineered right from day one. This is a ship lost in the Delta Quadrant going up against things that no other Starfleet ship has faced, and with no, you know, hope of rescue or help from Starfleet. So what could happen? Well, you know, not a lot. Not a lot of really dramatic sort of potentially, like, life-ending circumstances for the crew in the way that you would say, like, boy, that is much more extreme than Next Generation or the original series.
Well, I mean, before we kind of get into our first reactions that we had the first time we saw this, I'm just wondering, like, how does an episode like this kind of compare to, say, A Year of Hell, where you're actually seeing, you know, Starfleet taken down to just their bare bones and really pushed to the limit to see if they can really, I guess, live up to Starfleet principles?
It feels very similar, actually. Like, I almost feel like this episode doesn't happen if Year of Hell doesn't happen.
Okay. But let's talk a little bit about our first reactions, though. I mean, I saw this back in 1996, 97, I suppose, or 98. And I was kind of excited to see just, I guess this could have been like the what if sort of version of Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah.
A couple years later, we'd see another series kind of tackle this to a certain degree with the series Lost, which also featured prominently one Titus Welliver,
right,
who played Maxwell Burke on this one. And they actually had a different take where maybe we encountered some different survivors of the Oceanic Flight 800 that ended up on the other side of the island, and they had it much worse than the main cast members that we had been following for the first season of Lost. And this is kind of interesting in how, you know, we have Voyager doing this, you know, I guess like 7-8 years prior to that. I'm like, wow, this is a cool way to think about what if... I do think, though, Kim, you have a very good point. Like, would we be able to stomach this, say, week to week? And I wonder if this Equinox experience that we fell into, well, if it's only been going on for, say, a few months versus kind of this entire, I guess, 5 or 6 years journey that's, you know, that Ransom and crew have been involved with. But what was your initial reaction the first time you saw this episode?
Yeah, like, I had really no hype for this episode going in. You know, there was two-parters for Voyager that I knew about going in, like Year of Hell, or Scorpion, especially. But this one was just kind of showed up, you know, on my coming up next to watch, and I had absolutely no preconceived notions of what I was going to be tuning into. I didn't know the plot. I didn't know anything about it. And I was really wowed by it. I enjoyed the hell out of it when I watched it the first time. And I was just really impressed. I think it, I mean, if Year of Hell didn't do the job, this one really did, of really realizing that Voyager brought its A game to these two-parters in a way that I think even, like, say, TNG didn't always. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're watching Descent, I like Descent from TNG from season 7, or the end of season 6, season 7. I enjoy it, but it's definitely not TNG bringing its A game. It's like, you know, a decent two-part story. But I felt like with Voyager, they were really stepping up and taking angles on the show that they never would in a one-part episode.
And we'll probably get into it a little later on, but yeah. It's
there's a lot to talk about in regards to sort of the larger whole of Voyager in this two-parter.
But we'll probably have more to say about Chakotay once again, it always seems as if he has more to do. But I guess 20 years since I last saw it, and I kind of feel bad that it's taken me 20 years to get back around to it. But yeah.
Well, before we get to just talking about now, I am curious though, at the time, like with the marketing on this episode, when you tuned into it that week, did you have any sense of like sort of the gravitas of what this episode would be delivering, or did it just look like, yeah, just another episode of Voyager?
No, I think I got the idea that they were going to do kind of the dark version of Voyager. And I think it was actually something I was very excited about, because this is back in the days where I would still like eat up spoilers. Cam, you know me. You know how spoiler averse I am now.
Right.
Where, you know, I pretty much want to cover my eyes and plug my ears when I'm in the movie theaters and there's trailers coming on.
Sure.
But back in the time, I was like, wow, this sounds like a great idea. Can't wait to see this realized on screen. And I liked it. The cliffhanger maybe left a little bit to be desired. We can get into that later on.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me, yeah, it was a cool experience. It kind of lived up to maybe the hype that I had created in my own brain. I agree with you, though. I think it's weird that this one flies a little bit under the radar when it comes to Star Trek fans. And I wonder if it is because it's such a dark, I guess, feature on Starfleet.
It's not a fun episode.
Sure.
Definitely not.
It's got its moments.
It's got a couple, definitely in part one especially.
Yeah.
But overall, it's a very moody show. I even noticed right off the bat, the lighting on the Voyager ship is darker.
Yeah.
It's like they're telling you visually right off the bat, this is a dark two-parter.
It's a David Livingston episode, both parts one and two. Most prolific director in all of Star Trek. So he's got that on his resume there.
Yeah.
So why don't we get into it? I'd be shocked if nobody knows what episode we're talking about, but of course we encounter another Starfleet vessel in the Delta Quadrant, and they're experimenting and killing aliens to get their nucleogenic energy and improve their warp core performance and get home a little bit faster. So that's where we leave off, and slowly the Voyager crew figures out what's going on and calls him on that, and drama ensues from there. But what do you think about the character of one Captain Rudy Ransom, played by one John Savage?
Yeah.
Which one's the fake name? Which one's the stage name? I don't know. They're both real badass, Cam.
I actually think the name John Savage is a better name than Rudy Ransom.
But is it less believable as, like, the captain of a derelict, or not a derelict, but, like, a bad apple sort of... Captain crew?
Well, John Savage as a captain's name is a little too on the nose. You would actually say, look, guys, that's not subtle. But, you know...
What about Captain Ransom?
My problem with the name Rudy Ransom is when you say it, it sounds like a wrestler name to me. It's a little too goofy.
Okay.
I like what they're going for. You know, captains tend to have very punchy names, like, you know, James Kirk or Captain, you know, Jean-Luc Picard. Like, there's a certain flow to the way you say the captain's name, Jonathan Archer. Rudy Ransom.
Ronnie Cox.
Captain Jellicoe.
Yeah.
But, like, Rudy Ransom has that sound, but I don't know the name. It just sounds to me like a wrestler, like a 1990s wrestler to me.
Okay.
I don't know. Like, I like what they're going for, but there's just something about it that sounds a little too playful.
Well, let's talk about the captain himself, though, because, I mean, this is a guy who he says that first week in the Delta Quadrant, that's when he realized he couldn't play by Starfleet rules. And I also wonder that this is a great what-if scenario for Star Trek Voyager, in which, like, what if their first week went a little bit worse than the Kazon wants water from the USS Voyager.
Right.
You know, like, I can kind of understand how this guy realizes he's all alone on the other side of the galaxy and he can't really play by the rules. And it's kind of a fascinating scenario. Like, I think the Voyager crew, despite their encounters with the Borg, and, well, Janeway also put the Malon up there with the Borg when it comes to the higher echelon of Star Trek antagonists.
Yeah, what's the problem with that?
Okay, fair enough. But I think they had it a little easier than the Equinox did. And he even said that he lost half his crew in the first week.
They also just had a better ship.
Voyager. Yeah. Well, isn't it wonderful to see, like, okay, we know that Voyager is actually a relatively small ship.
Yeah.
And you see how it just simply dwarfs the Equinox as right. well. So I guess if you do the math, you can figure out that they had a crew complement of about 80 initially on the Equinox.
Right.
And Voyager has about double that. So it's about half the size of Voyager.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting thing there. And yeah, fewer resources. I don't know, but there's that very, you know, one of the first scenes where they say, you know, why don't we compare notes later on?
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun when they were comparing notes, like, oh, Ransom never so much as encountered a cube, but, you know, Voyager crew never encountered the party time aliens that give them those synaptic devices where you can see, like, alien vistas, right. for example.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But for you, I mean, this Ransom character, beyond his, you know, wrestler name.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think of one Rudy Ransom?
I really love this character a lot. I think John Savage is genius casting. You know, you can look at a lot of Star Trek episodes and say, hey, that was really well cast. But, like, John Savage brings a certain amount of baggage as an actor with him to this role. You know, this is an actor who's in The Deer Hunter. He's in Oliver Stone's Salvador. He's always in these very intense, in these movies, like, real-world survival situations where he often is heavily scarred. So we bring a lot of that to the role. He was in Carnosaur 2. I'm going to assume he was a similar survivor in that role.
I missed Carnosaur 2.
But I mean, you know, we see him up front in this episode, and there's so much intensity. He has that grizzled look, and he feels like someone who's just been through hell. Like, the actor, this is his wheelhouse, is these types of characters. And I think he carries it so well. It's right up there visually, right off the bat. The second you see John Savage, he looks like a guy who's seen things.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, he doesn't look like that fresh-faced type of actor in there. He doesn't sort of have that. You know, a lot of time when you watch the show, you see these sort of 24th century captains, and they always look a little too clean-cut and a little too bright-eyed.
Like one Captain Jellicoe?
Especially Jellicoe.
Yeah.
Star Trek sex symbol, Captain Jellicoe. Yeah, but I mean, a lot of Tiger Beat cover boy. But I mean, like, you look at Rudy Ransom and he just looks like he's been through the ringer.
Yeah.
And I think John Savage is just so, so good. It's weird that he's an actor who, despite being in some really, really notable movies, never really crossed into the big time. You know, in that 70s era where all these actors like Nicholson and De Niro did break through, or Pacino, John Savage never quite managed to get there. But he's just terrific. And I think Rudy Ransom becomes one of those great single or double episode, I guess in this case, guest stars that really lingers on in your memory and feels like he has a life well outside of the episodes he's in.
Well, okay, you mentioned earlier that, you know, it's clear sometimes TNG wasn't always bringing their A game when it came to two-parters.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Descent. I don't know if they're exactly bringing their A game to, say, Gambit as sure. well. For this one, it's very clear that they set out to give this character a very well-defined arc
yeah.
throughout. And it's also clear that based on stuff that was going on in episode one, they had broken both stories, you know, before they closed down for the summer.
Right.
I'm talking about, like, kind of the callbacks to the synaptic devices
sure.
as well as just stuff about how Janeway was, and we can get into Janeway a little bit later on, but she was on this path, kind of this descent towards hell, while Ransom was actually realizing his own mistaken ways. And it's kind of fun to watch them kind of cross their X's at the same certain point where
yeah.
they're both relieving their first officers for different reasons. So that's kind of a fun parallel between the characters. But it is fascinating to see how Ransom is somewhat redeemable by the end.
Yeah.
You know? And it's because they give him, like, a very well-defined character arc.
Well, I think also it really helps that Rudy Ransom as a character, he's intense, he's scary in a lot of ways, and he can come across as being antagonistic and potentially villainous, but he's also somewhat sympathetic and likable. Like, I feel like John Savage never crosses into villain mode. Like, there's something about him that there's always a certain dignity. It's lost, but you can see that he's kind of wants to regain that, and he knows he's done wrong things.
He's not twirling his mustache and...
No, he's not a Lorca.
No, exactly. But
yeah.
it's not as if he's, like, killing these aliens and thinking, like, yeah, whatever, no big deal.
Right.
Although Janeway does call him out on that and says, well, these experiments you're doing were quite meticulous. You
yeah.
could have stopped at any time. So I like how it's not, like, this clean-cut sort of, like, black-and-white scenario that's playing out. And my favorite part about Star Trek is when you take this, I guess, you know, very clean-cut sort of universe,
mm-hmm.
and you give the captains a choice between a bad decision and a worse decision. And I'd like to see how that plays out in, I guess, the very Puritan universe of the Federation.
So. Well, and I like, too, that when him and Janeway are going back and forth about his decision to use these aliens for fuel, essentially, he's citing, you know, Starfleet protocol as, like, any justifiable means to save your crew and your ship. And it really does open up this whole other discussion of, like, what is justifiable means in a situation like this, which is well beyond probably what Starfleet was thinking of when they wrote those protocol.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
What about the supporting crew members from the Quanox? Let's talk a little bit about Maxwell Burke, of course, played by the great Titus Welliver, who, I mean, all those Deadwood fans out there know that Silas Adams is one of those badass characters.
I like to call him Tuna on Wheat.
I don't get it.
TW, man.
Titus Welliver.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the running joke of this episode.
Oh, okay.
Is his,
tuna.
BLT.
No.
Yeah.
I thought you said toot on wheat.
Oh.
And I was like, what's toot on? You said tuna on wheat.
Yeah, tuna
gotcha.
On wheat.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you are chicken salad, what is Tyler Orton?
That's tough. When the last name is an O, that does limit it.
You could say...
turkey order?
Turkey order?
Yeah.
Well, we have Tom Paris's turkey platter.
Right.
Well, is there... And you already mentioned tuna. So there's turkey, there's tuna. Is there another T out there for, like, a typical sandwich?
I don't know. Is there some sort of lunch meat that has a T?
Okay.
People are really hanging on the edge of their seats to hear us come up with a lunch meat.
Yeah, okay. What about...
Oh, what about, toasted?
Toasted order of...
Yeah.
Something. Okay, listeners, let's get back to Titus Welliver.
I'll think about this one and try and get back to you.
Okay. No, but, I mean, this is a fascinating character in that, he comes on screen, he's kind of do the flirty thing with B'Elanna, even giving her the creepy belly pat.
Isn't that common?
Okay. With your exes from 10 years ago while current partner is standing right next to you.
I love that scene.
It was quite something, too.
Anytime you can get, Robert Duncan McNeil playing up, jealousy, it's really funny. I think he's got really underrated comic timing on this show. And often Star Trek doesn't do actors with comedic timing any favors. They don't frame it or shoot it particularly well. So you'll see these actors kind of flounder in a comedic scene, even though you've seen them be funny in other things. But I feel like this was actually really well done, and I thought Robert Duncan McNeil was so good.
Well, his best reaction was when Burke comes over to BLT, as he calls her, and
right.
he says, so where's my sweater? I think I left it behind about 10 years ago.
I mean, do you think he would have behaved like this if he hadn't been on the Equinox for a long time?
Maybe, yeah, all sense of propriety just evaporated from
him. Or it's just kind of like he's so almost been like... You know, when you're in a dangerous situation like this, all you can do is kind of be really nostalgic about the memories you have of the past. This is the best he's got.
Although, remember towards the end of part one, he's like checking out women on the Voyager crew, and Ransom says, don't worry, Max, there's going to be women back home on
Plenty
Earth.
Of women.
Yeah. It's okay. He has a reputation of being a horn dog, except I guess the problem is that pretty much all the crew's dead.
Yeah.
So good luck.
Yeah.
And there's only so much he can do with alien vistas that he's allowed to view through this synaptic device.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we were going to talk about the supporting cast before we got on our whole lunch order divergence. But yeah, Titus Welliver in this role as Max Burke. I really like this character. I like how he has that sort of smarminess in that scene with B'Elanna.
You mean Meatball Bacon.
Yes, Meatball Bacon.
Yeah.
But I do like that he has a lot of personality initially, but I do feel like it kind of fades throughout the two-parter. I don't know that when I get to the end, I have anywhere near as much, just interest in Burke as I do in Rudy Ransom.
Yeah, the problem with Max Burke is that by the end, he turns into that mustache-twirling villain that we were glad that Ransom did not.
Yes.
But I do like that we at least get established with his character as somebody who has at least some layers to him.
Right.
And we do get that with, say, Noah Lessing as well as Marla Gilmore, too.
Mm.
And these are characters that, look, they're not just, dumb kind of, bee drones that just do whatever they are told to do. Although, it's interesting, even when there's that mutiny going on in the Equinox in Part 2, Gilmore is still with Ransom, but it's only because she realizes, I see the error of my ways, so does one Ransom. I'm on board with him now.
Right.
And then... I guess Lessing to a certain degree. I mean, I was kind of disappointed about the character in that, like, we have that moment with him, like, his legs have been crushed for 2 days.
Right.
He's stuck in this Jeffries tube for 2 days with, yeah, like, crushed limbs. I would hope that there'd be, I guess, a little bit more of callback to that, but...
Sure, he is, or a somebody, little bit of a recovery?
Yeah. He is, yeah. Well, they actually point out, like, how quick he is to recover.
What does that mean?
I don't know. Especially with 24th century medicine, yeah, you know? Yeah. But I do like the fact that, you know, like, Gilmore acknowledges that she is suffering from PTSD. She's right. Not even comfortable being in a turbo lift, which is kind of I like those kinds of little nuggets that we get from, like, characters. Like, it adds depth to them that we often... Well, let's be honest, like, Voyager often neglected to do that with a lot of those other supporting characters.
Definitely.
Such as, like, I'd say Tuvok, how often did we get, like, real great character nuggets from him?
No, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so I like kind of the four main crew members that they established here for us to follow in Equinox Parts 1 and 2.
Well, they do play such a major role in this two-parter that I really do give Voyager a lot of credit for fleshing those characters out and making them feel like they could be characters in another show. Because, you know, a lot of other Star Trek episodes, you're introduced to another crew of a ship, and you go, well, you know, would I really care about this crew if I was following them week to week? You know, think of the episode Valiant, which in some ways is similar to this, in a way.
Yeah, I'd say so.
You know, you would not want to spend week to week watching the crew of the Valiant. Like, they just aren't interesting.
Starfleet. Or no, what was it? Red Squad.
Red Squad. Yeah. Like, they don't bring the charisma level or the level of depth of character that you would actually want to invest in. Whereas I feel like with these characters that they created for this two-parter, they really work as fascinating characters who could have supported a two-parter completely on their own with no other, you know, existing Voyager characters.
Yeah. I was very disappointed, you know, at the time when this two-parter came out and when Brandon Braga was doing an interview and somebody, I think this is one of those online chat rooms, and somebody had inquired, will we ever get to see characters like Gilmore and Lessing again?
Yeah.
He's like, nope, not interested.
Yeah.
And it kind of bummed me out because I saw potential for us to, you know, discover more about those characters' journeys.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if they're not going to spend time with, like, Kim or Tuvok, why would they go back to these other characters that showed some spark? And I want to go back to a bit of a news story that came out just this week with regards to an excerpt that came out from this new book called So Say We All.
Okay.
It's kind of an oral history of Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
And one Ron Moore talks about his time on Voyager, and he's just talking about, like, what a, I guess, bitter time it was. But he talks about Voyager, and his first credit for Star Trek Voyager was
Part 2, right?
Equinox Part 2. He's credited as co-executive producer. And he says, one of my few regrets with my association with the franchise is that brief but very unhappy period at Voyager. It was just a very unhappy experience and a mistake I shouldn't have made. I should not have taken that gig. I think I took it for the wrong reasons and went into it with the wrong expectations. When it went south, I clearly wanted to get the hell out of there. I remember when Brennan said he really wanted me to do it, and we had talked about it through the last season of Deep Space Nine. I did it just because I didn't want to leave Star Trek. I had been there for 10 years. I was comfortable there. I was making a lot of money. I love Star Trek. What he's going on to say, though, yeah, I guess I could have gone on and on with that excerpt,
right,
but
yeah.
It's like he felt that he could have fixed Voyager. He saw a lot of obvious flaws with it, and a lot of it was the fact that they had been setting things up, and then they just kept pushing the reset button. And
right.
I think when you set up all these character moments with the Equinox people, and then by the end, the reset button is pushed once again. Because
yeah.
Janeway and Chakotay, look, a lot goes down in Part 2 that we'll get into. But
sure.
Again, they hit the reset button on the relationship. And
yeah.
Ron Moore was not interested in constantly doing this with the characters. And I think he thought that he could fix Voyager. But he's getting into a situation where his former partner is now the boss of the show. And I think it gets a little tricky when you're once equals and then one has to be the boss. And I totally would understand from Braga's perspective why he would be a little bit insecure of, you know, Ron Moore coming in and saying, no, this is how you need to fix your show that you're running.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's understandable.
But I understand his frustration. We'll get into, because I actually read some other quotes from him regarding Part 2 that we'll get to when we get to that episode. But, you know, you mentioned earlier how they never touch on those other crew members who were brought over to Voyager at the end. And, like, to me, that almost feels like irresponsible storytelling to have those characters there at the end. dictating that they are going to have a path in the upcoming journey of Voyager, not on the show, but on the journey of Voyager, mm-hmm. and to pay that off in no way. Like, I think there's ways to write that out where those characters are not there and you are not left with the sense that these characters would be coming back. Like, original series or Next Gen all the time would have characters left over at the end. They would wrap up their story and move them off in a way where they didn't have to deal with, you know, fans saying, why didn't you bring them back? You know, why isn't this show more serialized or something?
You mean like Robin Leffler? Sure. Like, there seemed as if there was some sort of conclusion to that character.
Yes. So I really think that's kind of just really bad storytelling to even make that decision.
Yeah. Think about an episode like Friendship One, where you bring back Joe Carey.
That episode is not good.
I hate that episode.
It's like, awful.
So much. But you bring back Joe Carey
yeah.
just to kill him off, and you're establishing stuff. He's got a wife at home. He's got two kids at home. And look, everybody's watching Voyager knows that within like three more episodes, they're going to arrive back on planet Earth. That's just, it's one of those kind of destination-based series.
Yeah.
And it was so aggravating to have somebody like, you know, Joe Carey killed off. And it's just bad storytelling. Kill off like Noah Lessing or Marla Gilmore before you do it with Joe Carey. Because then it actually feels as if like, oh, okay, they're recognizing what happened, what went down in Equinox, and they're bringing back these characters for some sort of conclusion, as opposed to just rubbing salt in the wound of fans that have been invested in these characters for a long time.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree 100%.
So, you know, going forward, just with regards to some of the themes that are coming up within this, at least part one, though, is, mm-hmm. you know, the plan is for them to steal that field generator, the Equinox crew to steal the field generator from Voyager and just kind of leave them there hanging on. And let's get into maybe the idea of, like, would the Equinox crew not have been better just, I guess, piling all the resources into Voyager and look... It might not be as quick of a journey, but yeah. they're giving up a lot less of their humanity up until what they did at that point. They could abandon the ship, the you know derelict vessel.
Do they really want to stay on this death ship?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think their idea is like, well, maybe we can get home in like 3 months versus...
Is it kind of like a sunk cost theory?
Yes.
They've been on this ship for so long.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and they just can't imagine leaving.
But they're not using logic at this point.
Yeah.
And why would not a character like Marla Gilmore, who kind of... seemed, you know, kind of with it with the Voyager crew.
Right, yeah.
Why would she not say, look, hey, Chakotay, here's what's really going on. How do we get out of this situation? And I think they could have devised something much better than what eventually unfolded. It just seemed a little weird, but I think you're totally right when yeah. you talk about sunk cost theory here.
I mean, because Rudy Ransom doesn't feel like there's this like cult-like attitude on the ship with him in the way you would like in that Valiant episode with the captain on
sure.
that. Like, that really is like a cult environment where I don't feel that with Rudy Ransom. It just feels like they're very, very loyal to him. So you kind of do wonder why they are so intensely against joining with Voyager.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand maybe a couple of them, like Max Burke or something like that, but you'd think that maybe some of the lower ranks would be like,
Well, after they got used to just having like clean corridors
yeah.
and like, not eating rations anymore, wouldn't they be okay with, you know, just signing up with these people?
But it makes sense. It's a more secure ship.
Yeah.
You have a much better chance of surviving. Like, I would think just logically that Voyager does make a lot more sense.
Well, okay. So eventually they're like, no, we're going to screw over the Voyager crew, leave them on their own, which is kind of brings up, I'm going to go back to Lost once again,
okay.
because, of course, you got the Titus Welliver connection.
Sure.
And, you know, I mentioned Battlestar Galactica not too long ago. Rick Worthy, who played one Noah Lessing, he was actually featured quite prominently on Battlestar Galactica. So it's very interesting that Ron Moore connection as well.
Maybe I'll go into a parallel with Transformers Age of Extinction, which also had Titus Welliver.
That's very true.
I think he got killed with a football.
Spoiler. Oh, man. I guess I'm never going to watch Age of Extinction now.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that was keeping me there. No, but look, as we go forward with, you know, part two, we have this debate about, you know, do the ends justify the means? And I'm curious. I mean, Equinox crew clearly had it worse than mm-hmm. the Voyager crew. That's made very obvious.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, though, I mean...
Well, what would you, the worst you'd say that Voyager ever had it? I guess you could say Year of Hell, but with a reset button on that
yeah.
one, it kind of doesn't count. Like, what would you say was the biggest trial they went through that they actually remembered?
The most desperate that they ever were probably when they were stuck between 8472 and the Borg in
right.
Scorpion.
Yeah.
And like that's at a point where, again, we've got the Chakotay and Janeway conflict going on.
Sure.
Where I kind of get what Chakotay is saying, where he's just like, let's just kind of look, if it's going to add 10 years onto our journey,
yeah,
let's fly around Borg space. You know,
right.
I know it sounds awful, but like, I don't know what else to do at this point. And, mm-hmm. And I get it. But I mean, where are you at with regards to that question, Cam?
Well, I mean, I guess the reason that, yeah, I agree, like, Scorpion is a really good one to call out. Although I do wonder if, like, it has the level of ramifications, because ultimately they make a deal with the Borg, and they make it out of there okay. Like, it doesn't feel like they're really weathering a storm and walking out battered and beaten to the degree that, like, a ship like the Equinox is. I don't feel like that really ever happened in Voyager. I mean,
I guess
you could say, like, Basics was a little trying when they're stranded on that planet, but even that doesn't feel that intense, other than maybe the cave monster.
Well, look how they're left at the end of Equinox Part 2.
Yeah.
But by the next episode, they're okay again.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of Voyager's big faults that Ron Moore really was bringing attention to.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you watch Battlestar Galactica, which has a very similar premise as to Voyager,
mm-hmm.
It's very clear that, like, actions have consequences.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, the ship gets beat the F up. And it's kind of amazing how Voyager made it so far. And they're like, yeah, we'll just do repairs, or we'll go onto this one planet, land, and do repairs for, you know, a couple of weeks. And then we'll go back up into outer space. And it's just those kinds of episodes. Was that Rogue Planet?
Possibly.
Okay.
Or no, Rogue Planet's Planet from Enterprise. Yeah.
Yeah. Or was it Demon?
Yeah, I think it's the Demons. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Demons,
yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, no, I do feel like Voyager, despite its scenario for the show, the central premise, do you feel like they really weathered worse situations than, say, the original Enterprise? Maybe Next Gen, like, maybe they had it worse than the Enterprise D.
I'd say so.
Yeah.
But I would say that, like, the NX-01 had it worse during the Zindi arc.
Oh, hell yeah.
I would say that the DS9 crew, well, they were literally expelled from Deep Space Nine.
Definitely,
like,
yeah.
I'd say they had it worse, whereas the premise for a series like Star Trek Voyager would actually, like, tell you that, like, the Voyager crew should have it worse than anyone else, and then never really seen that way.
Because they should be fighting for those ideals in a situation that the rules don't apply.
So this is why I really think that Equinox is such an important episode, is that you kind of get the idea that maybe, you know, Star Trek Equinox is what we should have really been watching. And before we get into part two, let me just, you know, throw this out to you, Cam. Would Star Trek Equinox have actually worked week to week? Because I think there's two routes that you could go down, but what's your hot take on this idea?
My take on it is that it's complicated. Like, I find it hard to give a yes no, because I think, yes, you are 100% right in the sense that, yes, it's a show where you have escalating stakes. You have a ship battling the situation Voyager should be going through, where they really are having to grip onto something. But when I watch Equinox, that would be a punishing series to watch 26 episodes in a season.
Yeah.
Where it's just, like, crew members dying, and Rudy Ransom would not be a character who's giving you fun moments like, there's coffee in that nebula. You know, there's just not those sorts of moments of levity that you hope for in Star Trek. And it's
if he's creating a holographic girlfriend, it's way creepier than when Janeway made a holographic boyfriend.
Yeah, right.
So, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, but what direction is he giving the computer in this situation? Remember when Jane was like, I want more stubble. And it's like, this in, like, I don't know, the 1990s male-dominated writer's room.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a much creepier scene. That's all I'm saying.
I don't want to crawl into that headspace.
No, I don't.
But, you know, I think it's the type of show that if you did, like, an Equinox-style show now, and you had it, like, 10 or 13 episodes a season,
yeah,
it might work. But I do think in this era in particular, it would not have worked. And I think people would have really turned against it. And I think if you're doing Star Trek, people want that sense of optimism. They want that sense of hope. And I just don't know if an Equinox show that was like what we saw in this two-parter would deliver that in the way that people hope for. I think we've seen even a lot of people kind of vocal about Discovery, how they don't like how dark and violent it is. Some people like it for those reasons.
Yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of people feel like that's not what Star Trek should represent.
So I'm just going to go back to what we did find out about the Equinox crew, mm-hmm. in which we knew that the first week was horrible.
Yeah.
And I can imagine, like, the pilot episode being, like, you know, kind of a depiction of the first week.
Yeah.
And then from there, it didn't seem as if like the second week was quite as bad.
Sure.
So I don't think it would have been this constant, you know, barrage of negativity.
Yeah.
And also that we did find out that the encounters with the nucleogenic life forms, they only started a couple months earlier.
Right.
I mean, I kind of picture, you know, this Equinox two-parter actually being kind of the end of the Equinox journey,
right,
essentially. I mean, part two, it's spoiler like the, alert, ends with the ship blowing up.
It's the end game.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Like, I think it could have worked week to week, but not if every single week was an episode like Equinox part one or two.
Right, yeah.
You know, I think you would have had more of a gradual, I guess, like, descent for one Rudy Ransom. And let me pitch this idea to you. What if this two-parter, and look, I think this is a packed two-parter, but mm-hmm. hypothetically, what if, I mean, you have one scene, you know, at the start, maybe the teaser depicted, you know, year one for the Equinox crew. And then there was another scene in the middle that depicted year two, year three, so on and so forth. And you kind of see this slow descent for the crew. I think that would have been interesting to see where we find Rudy right. Ransom at the start. And especially maybe a character like Burke, who like BLT was totally into 10 years ago. But you see like what a horrible journey this has turned this guy into. And I think there could have been potential for us to accentuate why this was such a disastrous journey for this crew, getting caught up by the caretaker. What a bastard that caretaker
was. No kidding.
Really?
Yeah, no you know? Kidding.
And, well, anyway.
But, yeah, I do wonder, though, if you were to have that Rudy Ransom show, I don't know that John Savage is the actor. Like, I every time I've seen John Savage in something, there's a real coiled intensity to him.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time, like, he's the perfect guy to cast for Rudy Ransom at this point in time.
Sure.
I question how charismatic and giving off that Star Trek spirit he is in episode one. Like, I feel like he's still angry prowling around the bridge.
Maybe they would have had to give him, like, a really delightful wig at the start. But by the end, he's got, like, the shorter hair, and he seems way more intense, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or I know. It's like the She's All That sort of thing, where, like, he takes off his glasses in season three, and you realize he's just been this savage hunk the whole time, you know? So, otherwise, we just thought he was, like, Rudy Ransom, the exobiologist nerd.
No, in the first few episodes, he's got, like, flowing locks and, like, an open shirt.
Yes.
And he's, like, the sex symbol on the series.
Like Fabio.
Yeah, well, that's the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Like, Fabio was all the rage for that period of time around the I Can't Believe It's Not Butter era. Remember when he got hit by a bird on a roller coaster?
Well, I was just going to say, that was when he decided to start attacking the nucleogenic life forms. He got hit by the goose on the roller coaster. He's like, F this.
But you would have, like, the episode where, like, Rudy Ransom in anger cuts his hair. And it's like he's going into military mode, right? Like, he's losing sort of the luxury look, and it's more about we're going for functionality and, like, militarism.
What contemporary pop song would have been playing during that haircutting montage?
Bad to the Bone.
Okay, I buy it. Anyway, let's get to the conclusion of part one, in which the nucleogenic life forms start attacking Voyager, and it looks like Catherine Janeway's dead.
This cliffhanger full-on sucks.
Okay, Cam, can we talk about Voyager more generally?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they really they're good at cliffhangers. I think that Basics part one was an exceptional cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But beyond that, can you think of any good ones? I cannot.
What was the Year of Hell cliffhanger on that one?
Yeah, wasn't it like Tom and Chakotay at a dinner party or something?
I don't think that was the cliffhanger.
It wasn't very good, though. Like,
yeah,
the very fact that you and I can't remember what it
was.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was probably, you know, Anorax, like, zapping something else.
Sure.
Oh, no, do you know what it was? It actually was decent. It was when Janeway decided to separate the crew.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was actually pretty good.
That was actually good, yeah. But look at Scorpion, where, you know, the cliffhanger is...
They're on the
is,
run, basically,
yeah,
pulling a Borg
is
cube.
Is Voyager going to be destroyed?
Yeah.
Well, we know the answer, because there'd be no series if Voyager was destroyed. And just like this, do we actually think Janeway's going to die by this nucleogenic life form? No, because then there's no... Look, you're not going to go into season six and kill off your main character.
Sure.
You know, you just kind of know that. So it's like, this is not dramatically interesting at all.
I will say, though, in defense of the Scorpion one a little, it gives you an iconic visual. And sometimes that's enough. Because I would even say the same for Basics, with the shot of them on the rocks, seeing that, you know, the Voyager ship take off and leave them. Like, we know they're going to get Voyager back, but I do think that shot is really powerful. And so I will, I'm on board if they can deliver something like that even.
Why was Basics so much better? Like, look, you don't think that we're not going to follow Voyager commanded by one Maj Kala for the remainder of the series.
Imagine if that was the series.
But why was the Basics cliffhanger so much more exceptional than, say, the Scorpion cliffhanger?
I think because there was more of a sense of mystery, because you knew Lon Suter was on the ship and you're going like, well, what's going to happen there? Like, how is he going to take it back? And there's elements that you just wonder how they're going
to
do it.
To me, it's not so much the mystery. It's as if there are emotional stakes tied to what's going on. Whereas with the Scorpion cliffhanger, I don't feel any emotional stakes about a Borg cube blowing up.
Yeah.
And Voyager getting towed away by in a tractor beam by another Borg cube. That there's zero emotional stakes attached to that versus watching Voyager being taken away from the crew and the captain. I mean, that actually, that's a gut punch right there.
It is.
Star Trek Voyager Scorpion Part 1, that happened the same week that we had Call to Arms from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Think about just kind of the gulf between those two episodes when it comes to, you know, just that emotional punch in the gut that you'd get there.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Voyager is missing here with Equinox Part 1, the cliffhanger. It's like, are there any emotional stakes? Like, you know that Janeway's not going to die. And guess what? We come back in Part 2, in the very teaser, the alien bumps into her.
And she just, like, gets up.
And she gets up.
It's so really stupid. Bad. And it's so stupid. It's not helped by the fact these aliens look pretty terrible, especially now.
Oh, I'm kind of, look, you know, it was the late 90s.
I don't mind the design. I think the design is just fine, but I think the CG is horrific looking. It looks like cartoons floating around.
Okay, you've heard me complain, but like, why is it like Star Trek Voyager, their VFX are just as good as Star Trek Discovery's right now?
Yeah.
Like that, like, I think Star Trek Discovery's costume design is exceptional. The production design is exceptional.
Yeah.
The VFX are awful, and I don't understand why that
but
is.
You and I, just the other night, went to a 3D screening of the original Creature from the Black Lagoon from 1954. And, you know, we walked out of that and you said, like, why do the creatures look better in this movie, which would have been a B movie that would be shot fairly cheap in the 50s compared to nowadays? And it's just like, I don't even know. It doesn't even make sense
black
at this
white.
Point. Yeah.
Is that why Bride of Chaotica looked like the best Voyagers ever?
Black and white does hide a lot, to be fair. But no, it's just like, I don't know. Early CG has aged terribly in a way that early practical effects have not. And so, Voyager falls victim of that, but it's not alone. You know, there's countless movies that are in the same situation.
Yeah.
But, to me, these creatures, they look pretty bad. They fly around the ship in a way that's really unconvincing to me just to look at. And
they look like little kind of fairies, sort of.
I always thought of them as hummingbirds. Like vicious hummingbirds.
Like, the physics didn't make sense.
Yeah.
I'm more on board with the aliens than you are, but, like, the physics did not make sense of how they would fly.
I mean, I like how they come in through these little portals. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Although when this character's running around shooting these portals, it reminds me of a video game. It's kind of like when you have to shoot, like, the bad guys, like, missiles or whatever they're coming at you. Sort of thing. It's like, whatever. But, this shot of this CG thing flying at Janeway, I think you could frame that shot in a way that was semi-interesting. But the way that Livingston and the editors put it together with this POV shot coming into, like, bounce off Janeway's head, it's really badly done. It just doesn't even look good.
No.
And I think if you're going to end an episode in that way, you've got to deliver a visual that at least is striking, because at least that gives people something. This just delivers nothing.
So, okay, if you accept my theory that, like, emotional stakes need to be involved with a good cliffhanger, what kind of emotional stakes could have been tied to this particular cliffhanger? Because I've been thinking about it, and I'm not exactly sure what. Like, what makes this such a compelling two-parter? Would it have been tied better if we saw Janeway going more to the dark side?
I think that might have helped. You could also have introduced the Chakotay-Janeway rivalry earlier.
What if Chakotay was, you know, putting forward like a mutiny, which we never got to see on Voyager, and which I know for a fact the writers would never have agreed to do. But I think if you push Janeway to her brink, you have the Equinox on the run, and you have Chakotay fomenting some sort of mutiny, I think that would be a far more fascinating cliffhanger than what we got here, which was an alien bumping into the captain.
Yeah.
So.
like, yeah, I think some sort of moment where Janeway made a call and, like, Chakotay said something like, belay that order. And it's just like everyone stops, pauses, and looks around, and the music swells continued.
That makes sense, yeah. Because we know for a fact that, like, the writers would never have been, the studio would never have allowed
Definitely
the writers
not.
To do a mutiny, so yeah. If at least Chakotay is saying, belay that order, you know.
Yeah.
What's Chakotay's sandwich name, by the way?
Well, it's just one word, so it's like, I don't know, casserole.
Casserole? Is that a sandwich?
No, does it have to be a sandwich?
Yeah, it does. Okay, well, there's turkey platter. Yeah. That's not really a sandwich. So weird thing is, in my mind for the last 20 years, I thought Harry Kim said turkey pastrami.
Okay.
But it turned out to be turkey platter. Doesn't right. turkey pastrami make way more sense?
It does, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, I don't know. Your chicken salad. Yeah.
Chicken sandwich.
Chicken sandwich.
Yeah.
Chicken salad makes more sense, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, either one.
Your chicken salad.
Okay.
There's turkey platter, yeah. BLT, there's, meatball bacon. I'm trying to think of...
Titus Welliver is a tuna on wheat.
Tuna on wheat, which, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Rudy Ransom, we need a good one for Rudy Ransom.
Well, there's the Reuben, so,
Reuben on rye?
Yeah, there you go, Reuben on rye.
All our listeners are gone now. Yeah.
That or they're coming up with their own right now as we speak.
Okay. So. We still don't have a good one for me. Which,
no.
You know, T-O seems kind of like there should be something obvious, but I don't know what to do with the O.
Onion?
Okay, onion. Yeah.
Toasted onion?
Toasted onion sandwich? That sounds disgusting.
Well, it's very unappealing.
Oh, maybe that fits
yeah, maybe
me
it's,
then.
Yeah, maybe that's
okay.
appropriate.
Okay, so I'm toasted onion. Anyway, part two. One of my favorite parts leading off of this is we come back and Neelix is walking over the dead nucleogenic life form and I turn to you, it's like, yeah, that's going into Neelix's next dinner menu. Just like, which I totally believe.
Potluck.
Yes. Can we talk about that? Okay, yeah, we're skipping ahead, but let's talk about that last scene where like you and I both laughed when Chakotay said, so hey Janeway, I know a lot of bad S went down between the two of us, but Neelix is going to have a potluck.
I'm making the salad.
I'm replicating salad. He can't even make a salad. He's replicating a salad.
Right.
Janeway is like, I'll bring croutons. Does this not sound like the most depressing potluck dinner could ever imagine to boost morale?
If you're saying I'll bring the croutons, to me that's being like, I'm not even going to try. Like, that is the most phoned-in thing to bring.
What is kind of the most phoned-in thing to bring at, like, a party nowadays? Like,
although, you know, is Chakotay's name croutons.
Croutons?
Maybe it was code. But what is the most depressing thing, did you say?
Well, what's the most phoned-in thing to bring into a party nowadays? Like, contemporary 2018.
Potato chips?
I think you at least, you know, get to select different varieties. I think, like, if you're the person bringing in, I don't know... Oh, you know, the bag of little mini brownies. Like,
oh, okay. I like those.
Well, they're good, but it's kind of like there's no thought put into those. You know,
sure.
At least with a bag of chips, there's so many different varieties. You know, you kind of think about who you're going to meet up with. Are they more of a sour cream and onion crowd?
Sure.
Or are they more into the sea salt and vinegar?
Like, right,
I don't know. Whereas you bring in
ruffled
the bag.
Ruffled or not ruffled.
Exactly, yeah. But they bring in the bag of brownies. You know, which I've been guilty of, and they are delicious, but it's kind of like there's not a lot of thought put into them.
No, they're like the easiest choice. It's like, that's all there is. It's the one type.
Yeah.
You're not gambling on it.
Okay.
But I mean...
Back to sandwich names.
Yeah, but but I mean, Janeway, saying like, I'll bring the croutons. I'm like, first off, I think to myself, doesn't that kind of go with the salad? Like, wouldn't he handle that with the salad?
He's already replicating a salad.
Yeah.
So she's going to replicate croutons separately?
Yeah, like, try harder, Janeway.
This sounds like the stupidest party I could ever imagine going to.
Well, doesn't Neelix, isn't he able to make his own salads?
I'm sure he could replicate his own. Like, yeah.
Didn't they have actual vegetables on the ship they could use?
Well, I mean, that was Kes's job, right?
Okay.
So, yeah, do you think that hydroponics bay just kind of went like the way of the dodo bird, you know, when she left the ship?
Maybe.
Do you think when Fury came around, did she go and check in on the hydroponics bay?
I like to think so.
Okay.
But I mean, it does feel like Neelix has nothing to do in this two-parter.
No.
I mean, there's a scene where he's like investigating on the Equinox, but that's about it.
Yeah.
They couldn't even be bothered like having him on screen when they're talking about this potluck.
Well, somebody who had a surprising amount to do in this was the EMH. The doctor was really
cool. Isn't really that surprising, though? He's a pretty popular character.
It was, but you know, like, you wouldn't think that this is necessarily going to be a story with... Look, you can understand why, like, B'Elanna would have a lot to do, why Janeway and Chakotay would, but the doctor wouldn't necessarily...
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of seems as if they kind of wedged Seven of Nine's storyline into this. They're like, we need to find something for her to do.
Yeah.
But, and I'll talk.
Oh, my darling.
Well, let's talk about the doctor, because I actually think it is interesting that you have this one EMH on the Equinox who has his ethical subroutines deleted, and he's willing to turn into this kind of Mengele sort of character, which we've been down that road with the doctor before.
Definitely, yeah. And also Data. And definitely the Doctor and Data have some DNA linking them in terms of Star Trek storytelling. So we've seen that with Data as well.
In like his ethical subroutines? Or?
Not that specific, but where Data goes wrong, essentially.
Okay.
You know, we've seen that sort of thing on Star Trek before.
Yeah. Definitely with like a lot of the lore stuff that we witnessed.
But there's also that episode where Data like takes over the ship at the beginning. It's like a Dr. Soong episode.
That's a family.
Yeah.
Or no, brothers. Sorry, brothers.
Brothers, yeah.
I always get those two episode titles mixed up.
Or even the movie Insurrection as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
With this, though, I mean, we have kind of the... Look, it's interesting in that you have the parallel Starfleet crews,
mm-hmm.
and you actually have it taken to the nth degree with the Doctor just having his subroutines deleted.
And that's a question. Should these subroutines be something you can delete?
No.
It's kind of like the holodeck safety, although that one I can justify a little better.
Can you?
Well, for the purposes of Star Trek, I'll say sure. But, I mean, why would you have a doctor that you can remove its ethical subroutines? That doesn't even make sense.
I don't
know. Why do you need an unethical doctor?
I don't know.
What situation is that a good thing?
Okay, so my theory, I'll try to justify it, is like there are ethical subroutines.
Okay.
And Ransom just did an override and just deleted them.
Sure.
It wasn't like you can just turn them off. It's like he had to hack it.
Right.
You know, much like they did in the 1995 Hackers movie, which...
Where they could like change traffic lights.
Yeah. Or they could choose what song was playing on the radio station.
Did they really? Yeah. I don't remember that.
It's a really bad movie.
I love the internet paranoia movies of the 90s where it's just like they could do the most insane things.
Isn't it fascinating that it hasn't gotten really that much better in Hollywood with how technology is depicted? It all seems as if technology movies are kind of written by 60-year-old men.
Yeah, well, it's like that the last Jason Bourne movie called Jason Bourne where they just keep talking about the social media network.
Yeah.
The social media network.
Scary.
It's like, well, what is it? Yeah, it always feels a little awkward. Although I will say modern movies have much more believable computer screens than the old days.
Yeah, well, there's that other scene in like Hackers where they're looking at a screen and the screen was getting projected onto their face.
Right.
And it's like...
that was really common.
That's not how LED screens like worked back in the day, guys.
Do you remember the movie Swordfish? Where he's like connecting and it's like octagon spinning on the screen and you got to connect the octagons. It's like, wow. Crazy.
So, EMH, he had some cool stuff to do in this.
No, he did. I really like seeing Robert Picardo play this sort of like sinister, like psychotic version of the Doctor.
Yeah.
Like he's really scary. And I think it's always fun to see these these actors who play these robots, you know, quote unquote robot characters, being able to twist their persona just that slight amount. Like, they don't have to go full-blown evil. It's just that slight twist to make them, you know, because these characters are already not human, but to give them that kind of, like, really scary twist that I think is really fun.
Do you think it's kind of glossed over that, you know, when the Voyager EMH makes it back from the Equinox onto Voyager, mm-hmm. and he encounters the Equinox EMH, he says to him, computer, delete program. And the Equinox EMH is just gone forever.
Right.
He essentially commits, like, murder of a sentient being. Right?
Yeah.
And it's just completely glossed over. Were his ethical subroutines not back in play at that moment? Because he was on the side of the Voyager crew once again.
Right.
Isn't that a really weird thing that they totally just dismissed or never even touched on?
Yeah. But again, it kind of just like the Janeway Chakotay resolution. It's...
Voyager hits reset
over.
Button.
Yeah, it's just kind of glossed over. It's like, I feel like Voyager two-parters are built more around the drama of these of the circumstance. The ramifications aren't really there. It's more about building to this rising tension, a big kind of explosive payoff, but then everything that kind of happens around it is kind of disposable,
yeah,
in a sense. And I think you see that with the Doctor as well. But let's talk about the Janeway Chakotay headbutting, because that's something actually Ron Moore brought up in like the really angry interview clip that I read, where he talked about how like the problems with Voyager were that like there were no ramifications to Chakotay's, you know, conflict with Janeway in this episode. And the way Janeway just behaved on the ship in general, there was no lingering sort of feeling. She didn't change in any way. And that was part of the reason he was furious with this whole episode, which is actually, I think, a really fun episode and a really good episode, well written for the most part, with just kind of the caveats about the resolutions to it.
The,
but
the,
I
the episode in of itself works.
Yeah, it's great.
But afterwards, it's kind of like Ron Moore has a very good point.
Yeah.
None of it matters. Like, how do you get emotionally invested in what's going on if it doesn't really matter the next week?
Yeah, that's why I tend to think of Voyager with these sorts of stories as like a show that exists in the moment.
Yeah.
It's all about the moment. And I will say, the moments are fantastically well written. I love when Robert Beltran has things to do on the show, and seeing him go up against Janeway as she's, you know, going to torture this prisoner, potentially kill him, by letting one of these creatures into the room with him, which reminded me a lot, actually, of the Archer airlock scene.
Was that Damage? I think with
Damage.
Casey Biggs was the captain?
I think so. It's like, okay. Yeah, right at the start of season three of Enterprise. It reminded me a lot of that, actually. But, yeah, and having Chakotay stand up, and you have that scene where he's talking to this crew member. Was it Nessie?
Noah Lessing.
Lessing, thank you, yeah. Yeah, how he's just like saying, like, look, we're going to put you in the brig or whatever, etc. And you just see Janeway just standing in the background staring down Chakotay, and it is tense.
And when Chakotay brings him out of the cargo bay and she walks in between them and gives Chakotay
awesome.
The death stare.
I love it. Oh. I remember the first time I watched this two-parter, I was just like hooting and hollering over that moment. I loved it so much. And then right after that, it cuts to a briefing scene where the whole crew is talking and Janeway's a dead silent with like a darkened light on her in the background, like she's kind of in the shadows, just staring down Chakotay this whole scene as he's kind of giving the orders to the crew. I love it. Like, this is the type of drama. I mean, look, I think maybe I'm more prone to being into these sorts of scenes because I really, really love Deep Space Nine, and DS9 is all about these types of moments. A lot of people don't like DS9, so maybe they don't like seeing these characters really go at each other like this. Mm-hmm. But I really do enjoy moments like this.
Like the internal conflict.
Yeah.
Can we talk about how it's still the 1990s and the show is still, I guess, subconsciously misogynistic in that, like, Chakotay is...
There's plenty of women on Earth.
There's that sort of stuff, but Chakotay is dismissed from his job. Tuvok's now first officer.
Right.
And he starts calling Janeway irrational.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, boy. Okay.
Did he say that or illogical?
Irrational.
He used irrational.
He called a woman irrational.
Right.
I'm like, oh, good God, really?
Yeah.
We also have, you know, Rudy Ransom giving 7 of 9 the male gaze as well. I'm just like, oh, this is so problematic, guys. And it's just kind of like, it's this. I don't want to call it innocuous, but I think it's kind of this subconscious misogyny that was prolific throughout the 1990s. And it's like, I think they've gotten a lot better in Discovery.
Right.
You know, but you just see it all over the place when you watch, like, these 1990s shows, and it's just like, oh, good God, guys.
I mean, it goes to films, too. You know, you read a lot of film criticism now of movies of the past, and a lot of writing has been done. Very, very good critical analysis of the male gaze and this type of storytelling, and I think a lot of it was just no one really thought about it at all. I don't even think people thought about it in those eras, and it's sort of something that is fully recognized now and is being dealt with. But it's because it was just all male directors, and for the most part, and no one really thought about
it. Well, that's what really angered me when there's that interview with Robert Duncan McNeil, and they're talking about how, you know, they're trying to get a more diverse group of people within directing episodes of Star Trek Discovery, which is why he's not going to be going back and directing episodes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people, and I also noticed this is all like white dudes online complaining about like, how come they're putting unqualified people in because of like, and they're not giving white men jobs.
Sure.
Like, nobody's saying that these directors that are women or people of color are unqualified.
Yeah, exactly.
They're saying that white men dominate all the directing jobs in television right now.
Yeah.
Why don't we change that a little bit and get more diversity of viewpoints? Otherwise, you're going to have these episodes like this where I wouldn't call like Star Trek Voyager a misogynistic series. But
I wouldn't even really call this episode. It just has moments that you're like, oh, they wouldn't do that nowadays.
No. Or, well, honestly, like they still would. Yeah. But it's just I would think now there's far more filters. And I definitely think you get that with Star Trek Discovery where there's so many more filters. They're like, look, this you can't get away with this sort of stuff. It doesn't make sense, and it's not the way that people are going to be thinking, like, say, the 23rd century for, you know, Discovery anyway.
But, I mean, you know, you just think a director is an individual, and they make choices. And a lot of times, you know, you'll see that certain groups will make a choice that others wouldn't or something. Yeah. You know, like, I think one of the best examples that I really, you know, it's something that's more modern, so maybe people could even think about now, is watch, you know, the DC movies are terrible, but watch the way that Zack Snyder presents Wonder Woman in Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, and then watch how Patty Jenkins does it in Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
You'll see a very big difference in how they're framing the shots and projecting this character to an audience. And it's very subtle. It's not the sort of thing necessarily that's like in your face different, but you can see that choices are being made that, you know, that maybe a white male wouldn't even think about, but that Patty Jenkins does. And so I think when you have a diversity of directors on Star Trek, you can avoid a lot of these kind of moments just by creating more of an atmosphere of like, that's not the template of our show, doing moments like this. Whereas if that's all you're getting across the board, they're sticking to the template. You know, original series, all male directors, you know, very heavy on male gaze.
Can't wait for all of the hate mail you and I are going to receive from people accusing us of being SJWs or whatever. I say bring it on. I don't care. You guys, whatever.
I just ultimately find it fascinating because, you know, I'm someone who's obsessed with the history of film, and you see how directors change and how their approaches are, and you look at how the stamps they bring visually, and I think it's really interesting to look at how they depict events on screen.
Well, let's go back and talk about Creature from the Black Lagoon, which you and I just watched the other day.
Yeah, great.
And the thing that really bugged me, though, is like, I was like, oh, great, we have this female scientist who's in the main cast. The only reason that they have her as a scientist is they need an excuse for this woman to be on this expedition so that every time the effing creature appears, all she does is scream her head off.
Yeah.
And she doesn't actually contribute anything to the expedition. She doesn't have anything of scientific insight to actually give. She's just there to be the woman in distress. And it angered me because, like, watching, I was just like, look, it's the 1950s, and they're having kind of a more empowered woman who's a scientist. And I realized, oh, no, wait, they don't care about that whatsoever. It's just like...
Although, you know, it's interesting. You know, you look at the history of Universal Horror movies. You go back to when they began in the 30s. The difference in female roles in the 30s versus Creature, which is right at the tail end in the 50s, it has progressed. It's the progress now looks very archaic, but there was progress between the 30s to the 50s.
Progress
slow. It is slow, and when you go back and look at it, it isn't always visible, but... Again, you know, I don't think we'd see the moments in Star Trek now that we see in Equinox.
Fair enough.
You know, so and ultimately, I don't think they drag down the episode in any way. I just think they definitely do stand out from a modern lens.
It's just stuff that we probably would not see in season two of Star Trek Discovery starting in a couple months. So, anyway. Just overall, your big takeaway from, like, how does this one measure up versus other Voyager two-parters camp?
This is definitely in my top tier.
Yeah.
It has so much drama, and I think ultimately what makes it work so well is that it's a scenario that's just rife to be explored on Star Trek. It's something that I think a lot of the great two-parters have is just they come up with a concept that just works like gangbusters, whether it's Best of Both Worlds, Scorpion. Like, they have really great premises that work. And there's the sense that, like, this could be a movie. And I think that, that Equinox has that. And I think it is just brilliantly cast. And because the cast of the Equinox is so strong, they elevate this. You know, I think if you'd cast them with bland nobodies, this might have been a real drag.
Which is why it's such a bummer that they would not bring back, you know, characters like Gilmore or Lessing.
I know.
You know, it's just
what did you
like...
think, though, of, like, the resolution to the Equinox characters?
They're demoted and they're going to be
micromanaged. Not so much that part. I mean, you know, you get Rudy Ransom's big, you know, finale where he sort of redeems himself.
So, yeah,
and I actually really love that moment where he puts on that synaptic simulator.
Oh, yeah.
And is just staring at the beach as the Equinox, you know, explodes.
why not? You know,
yeah.
But it's good that he does have a well-defined arc, mm-hmm. and it doesn't come at the expense of, say, Janeway's arc, because she has one as well.
Yeah,
and it's good, and I do appreciate that even somebody like Burke, who's kind of like the charmer at the beginning, you're like, okay, he's got a pretty cool death.
He does.
But
it's very abrupt, though.
It is, but okay, I'll say it looks cool
and we get
to see like the life sucked out of him.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting that he gets like a well-defined arc throughout this as well, where we kind of see his descent and we do see Ransom's ascent to a certain degree as well.
Right. It would actually be really interesting to see like an Equinox story done on a show like Discovery, where they do these kind of 4-episode, 5-episode mini arcs on the show, or even Enterprise, you know, in season 4. Because I do think it feels like a pretty packed 2-parter, and I actually think you could have done more.
Well, that's why I kind of pitched that idea of, you know, like, what if, like, we had one scene where it depicted year 1 of this crew, and then year 2, year 3, etc. Like, I think if this was a 4 or 5 episode arc, we would have had time to actually get into it, and I think that would have been pretty cool and pretty interesting to watch.
Well, I mean, remember they were talking about how they wanted to do Time Zero for, like, 4 episodes? This feels like it could have been 4 episodes.
That Time's Arrow quote just never made sense to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it was ever a serious thought,
though. I don't think it was serious. I think it was more like they were impressed with the sets, and they were like, we should have done that for more episodes.
But it just would never have made any sort of sense to
me.
Yeah. Anyway, overall, I like you, I put Equinox in kind of my top tier of Star Trek Voyager 2-parters. It's up there with, I'd say, Basics and Scorpion and, of course, The Killing Game.
Yeah.
I don't know about The Killing Game. Yeah.
No. And it's going to be interesting because it is such a highlight, as we're moving into a couple of Voyager ones that are a little lesser known or lesser renowned.
You seem to be bigger fans of the ones that we'll be getting into in the coming months than I recall being, but I'm curious about how, I guess, they have aged over time.
Yeah, like, you know, when we get into Unimatrix Zero and Workforce and Hope and Fear and some of these ones, I am really curious.
Hope and Fear is not a 2-parter.
What is it called? Flesh and Blood, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, Flesh and Blood. I'm actually just really curious to see how those hold up, because I have such strong memories of, you know, Year of Hell or Equinox. Like, those really did have that impact, but I don't recall disliking those 2-parters, so I am curious on a second watch whether they're elevated for me.
Okay.
and Unimatrix Zero, I have, let's just say, I'm a little less optimistic.
Yeah. So Flesh and Blood, I actually, my recollections of that episode are very, very sparse.
Right.
Like, I don't know if this is going to be the most memorable one.
Right.
I'm mostly looking forward to Workforce, because there's so many memories I have out of that one.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the most gripping two-parter in my memory.
Its cliffhanger is amazing, and I look forward to talking more about that.
Well, we'll have fun with that, yeah.
Well, before we leave Equinox, we actually had a bit of a contribution. Jesse Okendo, who's been a guest on the show, wanted to chime in with his thoughts on the episode.
Hi, guys. This is Jesse Okendo from Oklahoma City. I heard you're doing an episode on Voyager's Equinox, the 2-parter, and I wanted to give you my opinions on it, because I remember this episode and I remember that time frame really well. This was, I think, right after the EU approved single currency, around when the Unabomber was sentenced. We had the tragic beating death of Matthew Shepard. And the Clinton impeachment stuff was going on, and we had that Littleton, Colorado school shooting. And the reason I remember this so well is because I was tracking current events at that time for my job, because we also had Y2K up and coming. And this episode brought a lot of things that I thought I'd never see on Star Trek to Star Trek, and I think it was based on current events, so that's why I remember it so well. I know the episode starts with Ransom saying, you know, we wanted to uphold Starfleet ideals, and he wanted to expand knowledge, and you know, that was obviously a lie. This is also a time when you saw Starfleet versus Starfleet in a way you've never seen it before. I've never seen Starfleet officers shoot at each other and totally have two different mindsets about what Starfleet is about. You know, Ensign Gilmore would say, you said you wanted to learn more about humanity. I guess we're not exactly prized examples. I'm sorry. You know, she says that to 7 of 9, who at this time is still learning how to be human, and retorts back with, on the contrary, you've taught me a great deal, which I think what she's saying there is, wow, you guys are complicated. I'm not sure I want to be one of you. And, you know, it was just interesting to see how they each had, Janeway and Ransom, each had a different way of approaching what Starfleet would do. Ransom's approach was, I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep my people safe. And Janeway took the grander view, which was, you know, we need to be safe, but we need to be responsible human beings because we represent Starfleet. Again, not getting into Starfleet's all humans, but, you know, that was kind of her assumption. And it was what brought kind of the dysfunction in that relationship between her and Ransom. So, you know, it was just, at that time, you just never saw all this. You never saw all this stuff. The only issue I had with the episode was really about the EMH, you know. So the ability to delete ethical subroutines at a whim, the ability to make it do whatever it wants to do, and then the doctor coming back at the end and just deleting the program as if you could... It just seems to me there'd be more safety protocols, especially based on other things that have happened to the doctor in the past. If you can look past that, then this is a great episode for me in terms of the story of the time. The story of the time was about, wow, I can't believe this stuff is going on. And Voyager, Equinox two-parter put into perspective, oh yeah, this stuff can go on. It can get a lot worse. Not going into what's going on in today's world, because obviously that's changed its dynamic. But I will say that this episode, just if you can get past whatever you guys are going to find wrong with it, I think it's a good episode just to give you a context of what we were in that time. Thanks for listening.
I like how Jesse astutely knows that we were probably going to like tear it apart to a certain degree, even though we both really like this episode.
I love it. Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
But I mean, it is interesting that maybe some of the criticisms that Jesse had, like we both shared as well.
Yeah.
And I always find the fascinating thing about Star Trek is like how much of its time it seems to be, which Jesse was bringing up there, but how timeless it also seems to be. And I think that's what Star Trek really does best.
Well, I like that Jesse brings some actual historical context in the discussion with an episode like this, because a lot of the time, the great retrospective film criticism or TV criticism is about talking about the times in which this episode aired and how it was important to sort of the climate at the time. We often miss that on the podcast because we watch these two-parters in the moment and do the podcast right after. So we aren't necessarily as tied to our memories of the times or looking at it from that point of view. Maybe if we were to write about them, we would bring more of that to the discussion. But I like that he brought a bit of that context because it does color the way that you look at an episode like this and, you know, kind of the attitude in the air and maybe what would lead to a darker, you know, Voyager two-parter.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, thanks so much, Jesse. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we are going to have a very, very fun, I can't emphasize this enough, a fun look at, I guess, the lower-ranking characters, the ensigns, so to speak.
Neelix? Is it going to be Neelix?
when he was deputized to be the security officer in Year of Hell, it's going to focus completely on that.
Oh, nice.
No, but you think about Star Trek, it generally focuses on kind of more of those senior-ranking officers, but there's actually been a lot of lower-ranking officers, and Star Trek even kind of goes on a bit of a divergent path every once in a while with episodes like Good Shepherd from Voyager, as well as Lower Decks. We're going to take a look at maybe those two episodes, but also focus quite a bit on, I guess, the main lower, more junior officers, not the ones that had like one or two episodes, you know,
right.
Like say that that Jenna that Data went on one date with,
sure,
know,
yeah,
for in theory,
right.
But we're really going to be taking a look at the prominent ones and justifying their existence on the ship and whether any of them should be getting promotions, whether they're long due. And we're going to have a bit of a fun way of tackling this that I think everybody's going to really enjoy. So I really appreciate everyone to come listen to next week's analysis of the way that ensigns are portrayed on Star Trek.
Awesome. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vendetta, Janeway had one, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's Reporton, N as a nucleogenic life form.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.